Good evening. Good evening. We found out a couple weeks ago that on September 18th, Sherry and I are expected to be grandparents. Very, very exciting news. I know I'm way too young for that. I know what you're thinking. But we're going to have another person, human being, little sinner to take care of in our family. Our church is we always have new spiritual infants here. So one of the things, when you have an infant, you know they can't feed themselves, they can't take care of themselves, they can't contribute really. And so when you're beginning your journey, even the scriptures use that analogy of a spiritual infant. We're still learning this and trying to take our walk, learning how to walk in the steps of Christ. And so the Southbrook Church is an experiment, really. It really is. And in how can you make something like this go when you're not attracting people who are already ready to give to it? So it's always felt for me, I've been here 23 years, when we first started this from today, only in recent years really has it not felt like it's going to fall apart at any second. Okay, so there's always that just sense of, oh, this is really an experiment. So I will not be with you until Easter, and I'll be gone for a little bit after tonight. And so I wanted to say something about that. We're about 262,000 behind on our giving, and the reason that that's critical to know is you look and you see all these people that are here. You know this happens three times, and you think that you don't matter. It's like, there's all these people here. I mean, really, they're not going to miss my part. But as many of you know, we broke this down. We have about 2,500 households who give regularly to Southbrook, either weekly, monthly, or yearly. And that's about 2,500 households. We broke this down that if just 816 of those households gave $500 a month, we would more than meet our budget. So you can see that there's no reason for a church like this to ever be behind on its budget. There's no reason. As resourced as most of us are, there's no reason. And so I've just made it very clear that it's real easy just to break this down. 816 of us say, hey, I'll take a unit or two or three of those $500 units. And I say this just because I have to, that Sherry and I do three of those units a month. Actually, we do more than that now with day one. And so we want you to know we're doing our part. But I want to tell you that, you know, because I've had people who say, oh, I didn't know that. Huh, thanks for telling me. When I said this, it's probably been 6 to 9 months ago, I mentioned this in this way and broke it down. You know, you break it down, a lot of times people respond. And so think about that with you, with your family. It doesn't mean that if you can't give a $500 unit a month, it doesn't matter. Maybe you can give one-tenth of that, and that's what you can do because you're a single mom and it's just crazy what's going on in your life. And Jesus is not measuring us in units, but we are, okay? No, we're not. But it does break it down for us. It does break it down for us. Okay, hey, I can do that. I can take one or two or three of those. I mean, our family's been blessed, and so... Just keep that in mind. We're going to do the offering right now, and so you ought to have a lot of guilt, if nothing else, right now. It's all grace, all grace. So anybody have their watch or their phone set for 9:26 this morning? Anybody do that? Yeah, a little experiment at 9:26 and 53 seconds specifically this morning. And if you missed it this morning, then you can do it this evening at 9:26. Was the official pi moment, 3.1415926653. And we're in the series about pi. Did anybody have a pi in pi's honor? Maybe you had a pi, yeah. You don't need a pi day to have an excuse to eat a pie. You're like me. But what we're doing in this series is we're looking at this. Today is the official pi day. This will happen again in 100 years. Where it'll be, you know, this exact moment in time, 3.14 and all that, 1.5. And it really goes back to, it begs the question, when you look at the reality of pi, is there a pi maker? I mean, for there to be this amazing, just this number alone and its implications, begs the question, behind pi, is there a pi maker? Is there a God? Or is there not? That's the most important question you can ever ask. Is there a God to whom you're going to be accountable to someday and I'm going to be accountable? Is there a God to whom we can pray, to whom we can serve and give our lives? Hebrews 11:1 says, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. What we do not see. And so on this Pi Day, we are looking at the rational reasons in this series to believe in God's existence. Last week I mentioned Sir James Jones, a British astronomer, very respected. The more I examine the vast expanse of space and the tremendous complexities of these things, the more the universe seems to be the work of a great mathematician. All the universe really is one great, gigantic mathematical equation. That's really what it is. And pi represents that infinity, that transcendence. One of our guys, Josh Boatwright, sent me an email this week. And I wish I had time to read it all, but I'll just give you his summary. Pi, it was really well written, condensed evaluation of pi. Pi is considered transcendental. It's a big word that can mean asserting a supernatural element in experience. So he said, let me summarize. Pi is not derived by man, extends to infinity, cannot be predicted, transcends our knowledge, is found rooted in every basic element of nature. It is the path of an electron around a nucleus, the number of rings in a tree trunk, the shape of a raindrop. Pi just is. And he said, that sounds so much like what I know about the God I worship. And that's really what this series is about. And we're looking at Psalm 19. So if you don't have a program, grab a program. You know, get up and grab one or just raise your hand. Somebody from guest services will bring one to you. But you're going to need that because what we're doing is we're just every week walking through Psalm 19, which is the great creation psalm. Now, what I'm going to present tonight is some pretty thick stuff. So you may want to move to the front row if you have trouble listening. But I'm going to try to draw some things and put some things on the screen to help you consider this, because if you are here and you're agnostic or atheist, then I'm probably not going to convince you. Okay, I don't have any illusions. But what I can do is make you think. And what I can do tonight is for those of you who do believe in God's existence, who are theists, that this will bolster your rationale for that. That it's not just based on experience and emotion. There are some rationales rooted in the existence of pi, actually, that are reasons for your belief in God. Psalm 19:1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of His hands. And what this speaks to is one of the rationales for the existence of God. And look, this is a big word. It is the cosmological argument for the existence of God. So if you have a pen and a program, it'd be a good idea to write some of this down. The cosmological argument for the existence of God, cosmological, cosmos, cosmological comes from two words, two Greek words, logos, which means reason. Okay, so whenever you see logos, it's reason, and the word cosmo, which means Kramer. Just checking to see if I'd lost you already or not, okay? Okay, you're still with me. Cosmo means world, okay? If you don't know, if you're too young to know what that means, what I just said, then just ask your parents afterward, okay? Cosmological simply refers to what is the reason for the world's existence? What's the reason? Why does it exist? It gets to the cause and the effect. And when you think of the cosmological argument or cause and effect, just think of dominoes. Just think of dominoes. Dominoes are a cause and effect reality and dynamic. What is the first cause of why the world exists? Why is there this gigantic, incredible mathematical equation we call the universe? Even David Hume, probably the most famous skeptic in history other than Doubting Thomas, said, allow me to tell you that I never asserted so absurd a proposition as that anything might arise without a cause. Without a cause. If you're a parent, big bangs happen in your house all the time, right? If you're a parent, big bangs happen frequently around your house that seemingly have no cause whatsoever. You hear this loud noise in your basement and you yell down the basement, kids, what was that? Nothing. Now, do you take that answer? Do you say, oh, okay, okay. Behind that loud noise, there was no cause. Behind that effect, of that crashing sound, there was no cause. No, you don't take that. You intuitively know or logically know that behind every effect, behind every cause, or behind every effect, there is a big bang. And the cosmologic argument says that whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, so it therefore, it has a cause behind it. Eminent scientist Sir Arthur Eddington said, the beginning seems to present insuperable difficulties unless we agree to look at it as frankly supernatural. One of the elements of the scriptures that I love the best, as much as any anyway, is the understated nature of the scriptures. And so often it says these things so understated. And the way the scriptures put that quote from Sir Arthur Eddington is this: in the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. John, when he writes his mirror reflection of the recreation in the person of Jesus, says, in the beginning was the Word. In the beginning, God. In the beginning was the Word. And so you see this cosmological reality. Behind every effect, there's a cause. Now, jot these down. The cosmological argument contains three rationales. The first rationale is the principle of sufficient reason. The principle of sufficient reason. And this just simply says that there has to be a sufficient reason to explain the existence of some things. The principle of sufficient reason simply says, look outside and what will you see? Trees. You'll see grass. You'll see water. And you conclude some things exist, right? Today we saw the sun, which we appreciate so much. The first notion in the cosmological argument asks the question, well, why do these things exist? What is the reason for their existence? Suppose for a minute nothing existed. There was nothing. Would you have to explain nothing existing? No, you wouldn't. But the minute something exists, the principle of sufficient reason says there has to be, in that split second, a cry, why does that exist? What is its sufficient reason for existing? That leads to the second principle or rationale, and that is the principle of contingency. One of the things when you look outside and you see creation, one of the things you'll notice is that all things are contingent upon something else. Trees, as we observe them carefully, need air. The grass needs water. Both of them need the sun. And so everything in creation is contingent upon something else. This is really an interesting deal because what we observe is that everything, including ourselves, is utterly independent for no amount of its existence. For every second of its existence, it is not self-reliant. It is reliant upon something else. It is dependent upon something else. From the minute it exists, it is dependent upon someone else or something else. And we conclude that all we see around us didn't exist at one time either, and it will not exist forever. The most potent reality of our existence physically is the sun. And we now know it's not going to exist forever. It's going to burn out. It's not going to exist forever. This is simply the second law of thermodynamics, which says that everything in the universe is in a gradual state of entropy. Everything. Everything is dependent on something else, and everything has a beginning and an end. It is contingent in its entropy. If you don't believe in entropy, have you been to a high school class reunion lately? Because if you don't believe in entropy, you will. Have you compared your high school graduation picture to a recent picture of yours lately if you need further proof that you're in a gradual state of entropy? Yeah. We do all kinds of things to intercept that reality that every single one of us, every single thing, the good news is that every reality physically in this universe is getting old as fast as you are. So you're not alone. And so the second notion says, we look at everything and we see that it is contingent. This is the principle. Now, why is that important? It leads to the third principle. This is now dig the dullness out of your ears. The principle of cause and effect. If everything we see is fragile and fading, it's entropying, it's contingent, it's reliant, what or who created, made happen, was the cause behind the explanation for all these contingent, fading, decaying objects and beings? If they all sort of feed off of each other and rely on each other, then who or what is responsible for them in totality? Let me give you a picture of this. Okay, here's a picture. Okay, so we're going to draw the universe. We're going to draw the universe, all right? We just drew the universe. So this is the universe, okay? This is the universe right here, everything. So everything you know, put it inside that circle, okay? Everything you know is going inside that circle. And everything in the universe is contingent. And the principle of cause and effect says, how did all those contingent things come about? Well, they could have only come about one of two ways. They either came about by some element with that is also contingent within that circle, or all these relying, decaying, fading things came about by some non-contingent reality that's outside the circle. And the principle of cause and effect says, logically, which assumption, which takes more faith to believe that it happened by a decaying element within the circle, or that it happened by way of a non-contingent reality outside the circle that would be utterly self-reliant, self-dependent, all-powerful, non-fading. Which, by the way, those adjectives get very close to a description of God. And this is just simply the cosmological argument. What the heavens declare in proclaiming the glory of God is this simply the cosmological argument says, what is the reason for all this? It is more logical to assume that all this contingent stuff happened by a non-contingent reality outside the circle. A thinking person will conclude that. And so for hundreds of years, this argument, the cosmological argument, has been debated and debated and debated, and many, many people have come to a belief in God just based on the rationale of this. Now that leads to the second one. I'm not done with this yet. Look at verse 4 of Psalm 19. We looked at this last week, but now I want you to look at it from a little bit different angle. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth, except Ohio in February and March. But other than that, nothing is deprived of its warmth. Now, we talked about this last week, the significance of the balance of nature and how the earth is the exact right distance from the moon and the sun and all that. And what that verse right there represents is what is called the teleological argument for the existence of God, the pie maker. The Greek word teleos means design or order. And again, logos means reason. So the teleological argument looks at the balance of nature within the universe, looks at the sun and how we have to adjust our watches to keep perfect, to keep pace with its perfect timing in its our rotation around it, and all these magnificent balances and perfections and precisions of nature. And the teleological argument says, it begs for an answer. Who or what is behind this intricate, amazing design? Philosopher William Paley said, there simply cannot be a design without a designer, contrivance without a contrive, order without a choice. And the teleological argument just simply says, what we see around us, it takes an incredible amount of faith to believe that it came about by sheer chance. That's what's in vogue today. As you know, it's what's taught in our schools, that a chance collision of floating gases out in space set in motion a random series of events that over billions and billions of years finally brought us to the complex state where we are today. And so the teleological argument comes along and says, really? Really? It takes more faith to believe in that than that there is a designer behind that design. Throughout history, this has been called the watchmaker argument. You don't look at your watch and say, huh, where'd that watch come from? Well, I don't know. There was an explosion in a steel factory one day, and now came this watch. The watchmaker argument, the theologian says, no, behind a watch, there is a watchmaker. In about a year or so, year and a half, we'll have a celebration. It would be the completion of our new chapel and the expansion of our building, and we'll come and we'll invite our architect, John Poe and Associates, and our builder, who we hope is really good and really cheap, and And we'll invite them to celebration. That'll be a great day. Nobody will go, architect, huh? I never assumed there was an architect behind this. I just thought there was a tornado that came through and there was some steel laying around somewhere and out came this building. Now, obviously, I'm being facetious here, but the teleological argument says behind a building, there's an architect, there's a builder. It is just logical. None of us think that it's just totally things that have designed or by chance. And by the way, Romans 1:19, Paul says that our creation, which is so much more complex than any watch or building, what may be known about God is plain because God has made it plain. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made so that men are without excuse. Charles Darwin, have you heard of him? Charles Darwin, the kingpin of evolutionary theory. And by the way, let me stop for a minute on this. This is really important to understand. I'm not a doofus who doesn't see that there is evolution in nature. I am a believer in microevolution. I'm not a believer in macroevolution, that something came from nothing by chance. And so sometimes, you know, if I use the word evolution, you get dismissed intellectually as, well, it's totally impossible to deny microevolution. Things evolve. Things, they do. Many of you are taller than your dad, you know, that kind of thing. But Darwin was the initiator, the catalyst behind, we now know, Darwinian evolution, which says that all this came by chance. And in a chapter in Origin of Species, Origins of Extreme Perfection and Complication, he said, to suppose that the human eye, with so many parts all working together, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. Now, what's amazing about that is go to an eye doctor and talk to him and ask them what we know now about the human eye compared to what Charles Darwin knew about the human eye or about the single cell. What we know about the single cell, based on than what Charles Darwin knew, it's unbelievable. And even there, Charles Darwin saying, the chance that the human eye came about by chance. Here's all I'm saying. The teleological argument suggests that it takes much more faith to attribute the wonderful symmetry of our world to the chance collision of gases than to a supreme pie maker. A great mathematician who designed it and for our utilization. It just takes more faith. If you're hearing, you know, some of us look at nature and say, this proves God doesn't exist. I understand that. Some of us look at nature and say, this proves God exists. I just want you to know, it takes more faith to believe it's by chance than it does to assume there's some non-contingent reality outside of us whom we cannot fully grasp that is behind it all. And I'm just going to share a few of these. I love what Lee Strobel says. He talks about the complexity of creation. And I'm a hick from Newark, Ohio, so this really speaks to me. He said the idea that creation and its complexity came about by chance, it would be like an infinite number of rednecks riding in an infinite number of pickup trucks, fire an infinite number of shotgun rounds at an infinite number of highway signs. They would eventually produce all the world's great literary works in Braille. That's the odds of this complexity coming about by chance. I mean, I saw this quote this week. A man is like a fine wine. He starts out as raw as grapes, and it's the woman's job to stomp on him and keep him in the dark until he matures into something she'd like to have dinner with. You see, there's design behind every good man, right? Behind every successful man, there's a surprise mother-in-law. Everybody knows that, right? But we don't ever think of anything that is the result of design is a result results in design is the result of just mere chance. And the teleological argument just simply says all of us have faith. Even the atheist is putting faith in something. Today's Albert Einstein's birthday. Gene Jesse just told me. Einstein put it well when he said, I think I know 2% of all there is to know. It's very possible God exists in the 98% I don't know. I don't know about you, but I'm not as smart as Albert Einstein. It's very possible that a non-contingent reality that I cannot even grasp exists in the 98% that I don't know. And that leads to the third argument in this look at verse 14, 13. Keep your servant from willful sins, that they may not rule over me. Then I'll be blameless, innocent of great transgression. And look at this. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Those words represent one of the arguments for the existence of God, and that is the moral argument. The moral argument. The idea that we have a conscience. There are three reasons I believe in God. Third reason is creation. The second reason is conscience. And the moral argument just simply says, is it possible that a collision of gases creates this conscience, this idea that there is a right and wrong that transcends almost every culture? Go to any culture, and there is some moral code. Now, just like the creation argument, it's not a complete argument, because creation in itself is flawed, right? It's tainted, it's fallen, we have ill spills and wills, we have germs, we have accidents, we have awful, horrible, evil wills being put upon others who are innocent. So creation is not a perfect argument for the existence of God, it's incomplete. Conscience is an argument, it's not complete, because the conscience can be seared, the conscience can be contrived in such a way, some of you grew up in religious environments where you were made to feel guilty for things in your conscience that you shouldn't feel guilty for. I mean, it's just crazy what we can do. But look at this in Romans 2:15. Paul said that even unbelievers are accountable to God because of their conscience. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. And this argument just simply asks the question, when you look at the universe, how does one account for the fact that in human beings everywhere, there is a moral code? Did that happen because we evolved from primeval gases? Who accounts for that? Are gases or germs or genes capable of a universal moral code of values and planting them in the hearts and minds of people worldwide? This is simply asked the question, which takes more faith? To believe that this happened over time and by chance, this universal code, or that a creator imprinted upon us this coding, this conscience. Romans 2:15 says the conscience sometimes accuses and sometimes defends. We have this, almost everyone in the world, unless it is totally seared, has this conscience that is like a pain mechanism that says, don't do that. And when you do it, you don't, if you felt bad about that, didn't you? I told you not to do that. Stephen Wright, the comedian, says the conscience is that thing that feels bad when all the other parts feel good. You know, I don't know if that's totally true or not, but Mark Twain said, man is the only creature that blushes and the only one that needs to. Why do we blush? Why do we feel good when we didn't really feel like going to church tonight, but we came anyway, and then we feel good about it afterward? Our conscience feels good. I mean, if you're lazy, your self-esteem is low, but if you work, there's a sense of fulfillment. It's because God has placed within us this conscience, this mechanism. Now, what's interesting about that is this. Acts 17:27, the Apostle Paul is speaking to a bunch of people in Athens, Greece, who just know false gods. They don't know the real God. They even have in case they have all their insurance bases covered, and there are hundreds of idols in their town. They have an idol that they call the unknown God. Just in case we miss one, there's the unknown God. And Paul says, he goes into Athens, he says, I want to talk to you about that unknown God. Let me talk to you about him. This is the God I know, he says. And in Acts 17:27, he says this, God did all this, creation, Christ, so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. The moral argument says this, not only did God put a conscience in us that has some mechanism of right and wrong, but that within man, there's almost this incurable desire, innate desire for something beyond, something transcendent. Go to almost any culture, there is a worship of God or gods, creators. When we were in Egypt, we learned about the goddess Maat. and the goddess of order that made Egypt go and held Egypt accountable when Egypt didn't work. I mean, in every culture, there is this incurable desire, this seemingly innate sense that there is some non-contingent reality that's outside of us. And the best story I've ever heard on the moral argument comes from Helen Keller. Remember Helen Keller? Born blind, could not hear, maybe the most objective of human beings. And the day that Annie Sullivan broke through the communication barrier with her, the next day, Annie Sullivan said, "Helen, I want to talk to you now about God," you know, through the sign language. And Helen Keller's response was, "Good. I have been thinking about God for a long time." An amazing sense of this moral argument, this that we are embedded with this idea of a transcendent, non-contingent reality outside of us. Now, I mentioned that there are three reasons I believe God exists. Creation, which is a tremendous argument. Behind pie, there's got to be a pie maker. Conscience is my second reason. But if it weren't for the first reason, I'm not sure even I would be a believer. Because the number one reason I believe that God exists is Christ. If creation doesn't convince you, and conscience doesn't lead you, what do you do with the person of Jesus Christ? Monday morning when you flip on your laptop and the date flashes, it is a declaration that the life of Jesus Christ split history into two parts. His presence on this planet cannot be denied. What do you do about the one who said, "Do you not know? Have you not read? In the beginning, God created them male and female." He's the number one reason that I believe in God. And if I were agnostic, I would have to explain away the person of Jesus Christ. Hebrews 1:3 says, "In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things and through whom He made the universe." The pie maker's name is actually Jesus Christ. "The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of His being, sustaining all things by His powerful word." I was at Stebbins High School this week, and one of our people, Christy Rumbacher, is a teacher there, and she brought me in to have the students, or some of her students in a post-school group, just ask me any question they wanted to ask. And one girl, this is not her name, I'll say Deborah, it's not her name, just a sweet, smart, bright girl, and she, through conversation, she said, "You know, I was 8 years, the first 8 years of education in parochial religious school, so," she said, "I'm an atheist." Which is not the effect that I think that they wanted to have by putting her in 8 years of parochial school. But that cued me in. As soon as she said that, I knew what that meant. And I said, "Deborah, if you and I could have a conversation," I said, here's what I would want to know. I would say, "Tell me what God you don't believe exists. Because I bet I don't believe that God exists either. Because I bet you believe in a rule maker God, that all He cares about is rules." She said, "Yeah." See, the God I believe exists, His name is Jesus. He's the exact representation of the pie maker. You want to know what God's like? First question that you can ever ask is, does God exist? The second question that logically follows that is, what is He like? And the scriptures, the gospel proclaims, you know what He's like? He's like this. Look at Jesus. Jesus said, "If you've seen me, you have seen the Father. The Father and I are one." And if you're here tonight and your life is, you're wondering what it matters because you've been told that all you are is the chance collision of gases. In actuality, if that's true, your body can be profane because it's nothing but a bunch of stuff. It means nothing. It means nothing. You're an animal. Act like one. Would you please? And our world says, "Yes, I will." But if that's not true, then your life means something. It means something. And there are so many things he promises, but he promises two things. He promises purpose. H.G. Wells said, until a man has found God, he begins at no beginning and he ends at no end. Until you have found God, you're trying to cross the Niagara Falls and you're not sure if the rope is attached well on either end. But enjoy the walk. Because our world, your schools are telling you, your universities are telling you, we don't know where you came from, we don't know where you're going, but eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Because all we're doing is rearranging the furniture on the Titanic. That's all we're doing. We're remodeling the Titanic. Woo! No wonder we're drug addicted. It's because we were born for meaning, and Jesus Christ says that you can seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be given to you as well. And he is not far from you. The kingdom is near, he says. It's in your heart, ready to be accessed. He promises a life of purpose. He promises a life, listen, of protection. He promises a life of protection. Now that sounds crazy in a world that seems so scary. It sounds crazy in a world where women and children are being raped for being the wrong religion. But Jesus said, listen to this, that you don't have to live afraid because this is my Father's world, he said. And in everything that matters, in looking at your life from an eternal perspective, you are protected in everything that matters in me. You're secure. Your past is forgiven. Your present is empowered. Your future is secure. And you do not need to fear. Number one command in Scripture that this God Jesus gave was, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Why? Because this is my Father's world. Dallas Willard said these words that have really resonated with me, and I think it does in a world that is so afraid. He said, the gospel of Jesus proclaims this truth. This is our Father's world, and so it is a perfectly safe place for you and I to be. Think about that. Think about that the next time you're afraid of things that haven't even happened yet. That this God exists and he is in charge, and the God who designed pie knows the very hairs on your head. He knows when a sparrow falls to the ground. He's not only creator, he is your redeemer and he's your savior. He is intimate with all your ways. Think about that. So what I want to do to close this out, this scientific thing we've gone through, is reach us in our hearts. And so I'm going to close with this. There's this picture. Every time I hear this old, this is one of my favorite old songs. This is my Father's world. It's a British vocalist by the name of James Loyne who performs this. And I want you to just sit, and when you're ready to go, leave. It's about 4 minutes long. We have the symbols of the God Jesus' body and blood, that he really did walk on the earth. That every time we take of these, we are proclaiming that he did live, that God did show himself in the person of Jesus Christ, and that that God went to our death for us so that we could live forever, so that we could be protected and have purpose. And so I'm just going to pray right now, and you just sit and listen to this, watch this video as long as you want. If you're ready to go, go. If not, stay. Because this is your Father's world. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you hear us, that we can call you Father because Jesus said, what is God like? He is like an Abba, a daddy, powerful yet intimate, strong yet gentle. And we can come to you, we can live lives of purpose and strength in what sometimes seems like a very dangerous place to live. So we celebrate tonight the reality of your non-contingent reality among us. We welcome you in, and we say thank you for creating us in your image, for restoring us when the world destroyed us, and for the truth that this is our Father's world.